So a couple months ago, Stacy and I were talking, and I was saying, Stacy, who can we bring to St. Andrew Wildflower to talk to this community that Stacy and I, you know, we love every one of you so much, and we're like, who can we bring just to, that would bring some inspiration, that would bring some encouragement? And we started talking about Krista and Paul and just how phenomenal they are as people. And so Stacy was like, that's who we need to bring, Krista Romig-Levitt. Bring Krista here. It will be amazing. And so then I started thinking about it. And I was like, oh, this would be so great. And so I reached out to Krista and said, hey, here's what I'm thinking. Here's what would be wonderful. And I want to tell you a little bit about Krista just before she, but I'm going to kind of give you the unofficial bio. Krista was a theater major, and she's a playwright. But what I most love about her is that she... it's a couple things. She has this way of being deeply authentic and real, and then in the very next sentence, like, just deeply thoughtful about life. And then she's absolutely hilarious. I mean, she's funny, like deeply funny, where all of a sudden she's honest and real, and all of a sudden she says something, you're like, that's funny. Like, really funny. And so I was like, she would just be so great to bring here with you. Her and her husband are deeply committed to the church, deeply committed to ministry. And she'll probably tell you a little bit about that. If she doesn't, we'll let you know about their website and with Torn Curtain and all that they're doing. And then I was like, her husband actually serves a church, and so he can't be here this morning. And I was like, I said, well, he has to have some say of what he wants to say to her before she speaks, you know? It's not every day. And so he said, I would love to say something. So I said, hey, Paul, tell me something about Krista that, you know, the unofficial biography stuff. And here's what he said. First, she likes gin the best. So we're going to lighten it up right before she speaks, you know? And then she laughs the hardest when we are watching New Girl and Nick screams. It's good. It is. It's really funny. And then lastly, she will not eat fast food, but every once in a while, usually around 9 p.m., she craves a burrito supreme from Taco Bell. So now you know the real stuff of Krista Romig-Levitt. And then he adds this. This is the like, ah, husband moment. I'm constantly grateful that God gives me the blessing of being pastored by my wife. Often my only centering moments during the day are listening to her at our kitchen table about what she is reading or learning. I'm excited that you all get to hear her words too. God uses them in my life. I imagine he'll do the same for you. So we're so excited. No pressure now that I built that all up. But she's wonderful and lovely, and I'm so thankful she could be with us today. Krista Romig-Levitt.
That was really nice. And I didn't know any, well, I mean, I knew like the true things that Paul shared with you about me that are very true, but I didn't know you were going to get to learn them as well. So I just wanted to start with saying that I'm really mostly here because Dale called at a really lucky time for him. He doesn't know. He called and he left a message on my phone literally minutes after I finished reading Brené Brown's book, Daring Greatly. And if you have not already read this book, it is lovely. It's about vulnerability, shame, and courage. And I think everybody in this room should read it. We'll all get together and drink gin afterwards. But I missed Dale's call. And in listening to his message, my heart started to beat quickly because I knew that I was going to have to say yes to doing this. And it made me really nervous. I used to do this kind of thing a lot, or often, but for the past 5 years, I've mostly mothered my two daughters. And so this chance to speak and to give away my thoughts and my voice made me a little extra nervous. But after reading a book about courage and vulnerability and how important it is to practice those things and practice daring greatly, I knew that I wasn't going to say no. I knew that I was going to come today and share myself with you and practice daring greatly. So I just wanted to say thank you to my lovely friends, Stacy and Dale, for thinking of me. And that really, it's all just because Dale called at like the perfect moment. And before we really start getting into things, I would like us to pray. God, we are now into Easter. And all the unimaginable things that that may mean for us. Help us. Help us to practice Easter and learn more about new life and new creation. May we have the courage to lean into resurrection. May we have the vulnerability to look into and out of death and to see what may come next. Thank you for this moment. Thank you for mysteriously being with us in this place and time. Amen. So I recently heard that a good question to ask in order to get to know someone is, so tell me about your mother's mother. And I think this is a really creative thought. We all come from a woman, a womb in which we were carried and built. And it was really intriguing to think about how I could be known and how I could make myself known through a woman who was two generations removed from myself. And I realized very quickly that I didn't want to talk about my mother's mother, and I forced myself to sit with that and confront it. My mother's mother was named Mary May, and I have only a few memories that are connected with her that aren't tainted. I remember watching Johnny Carson on The Late Show, and she would make warm, toasted white bread with butter. I remember her rubbing my back while I took naps in her bedroom with blue painted walls. I know she wanted to be a concert pianist, but instead she became the third wife of a man who was emotionally neglectful and abusive. She had four children and sat in the very back row of a Methodist church in a small town in Kansas. She knitted, crocheted, and tutored kids falling behind in elementary school. But what I mostly remember about her is that her love wasn't unconditional. It was actually very limited and had many uncommunicated rules that I feel like I mostly failed to follow. My mom always said that Mary's fault was in loving too much. Her love had a really tight grip, and for Mary, that kind of love failed to keep a hold of what she wanted most, which for her was her children and her grandchildren. It is with joy, however, that I think about my father's mother, Leora Winifred. She was a librarian and a poet. An avid learner and reader, she was always really easy for me to adore, and I still kind of want to be like her when I grow up. She survived a physically abusive father and an alcoholic husband. Her husband, my grandfather, eventually did find AA and sobriety, and AA became a pillar of their life. They were always, even into their 80s, talking about sobriety and helping others and sharing stories and sharing their ears, helping others towards AA and sobriety. She kept a meticulous house and was the first to alert me that I also clean as a coping and controlling mechanism. She made fun of her nose. She, not my grandfather, taught my dad how to climb trees. She really liked the colors white and yellow, and I don't know why. She hated her name, Leora, and she went by Lee. But I have named my youngest daughter Leora. It means God's gift of light. And Lee knew how to light a room and work a room. She was a great conversationalist. She was a greeter at Faith Mountain Fellowship in the small New Mexico town where she lived. She also always told me that I was beautiful, and somehow I managed to believe her. Death has come now to both Mary and Leora, and it has ended their stories. But it isn't a complete ending, because here I am talking about them, sharing them with you, and so they aren't finished. So though death has most assuredly come, it hasn't severed everything. But death is hard. I think it's ugly and damnable and has a finality that I hate. And I also kinda really don't like Easter, because Easter's hard for me. And I think it's because when I ignore death, like I really most often try to do, then I don't get the Easter. Choosing to walk through death, even like we tried to do last weekend through Good Friday and that weird in-between Saturday, is really awful. And I think that most of us don't really choose to commit to that all the way. And I'm not even sure really what that would look like, but I know that for me, when I choose the death, then I actually can find the Easter. Because Easter does come, even if it's just through a day on the calendar. I just finished reading this book called Dirt, and I will gush about it later. And that is exactly what it was about. Dirt, soil, sand, rocks, clay, holes, earth. And the author, William Bryant Logan, writes about humus. He writes a lot about it in the early part of the book. Now, humus is what your compost pile breaks down into. It's that dark black stuff at the bottom of the heap. And gardeners know that this is the good stuff. Humus makes a huge difference whether it's helping a rosebush in Highlands Ranch or a tree in the Amazon rainforest. So I'm going to geek out for a minute on this stuff, because even though no part of me is a scientist, this information really just impacted and inspired me. So if you get totally bored, that's okay. Close your eyes. Somebody will elbow you when it's over. So here we go. Gently, we'll gently elbow you. So humus shares a connection in etymology with the word human. And humus and human share a connection with the word humble. And all these words share root words that mean of the ground. But humus doesn't refer to the ground at all. Humus instead refers to the final product of decay and dead plants and creatures. And no two humus molecules are alike. Every time scientists attempt to break down humus into its basic components, they get acids of a slightly different nature. So like snowflakes, like human fingerprints, no two pieces of humus are exactly alike. And because scientists can't reduce humus to definitive molecules, there is no way to say exactly what it is or exactly how it will behave. It is undefinable. But we can understand some of what humus does. Without getting too technical, it uses heat and water and basically helps to reuse plants. It helps soil particles stick together, which helps plants thrive in the soil. It helps soil hold and absorb water. It suppresses and eliminates disease. And it resists decay. It resists decay. Logan states that radical disorder is the key to the functions of humus. It may be one of the most disordered materials on Earth. So basically, we have a radically disordered material that is the result of decay and death, but which itself resists decay. Logan also writes, neither humus nor humans, remember they all share root words in connection, neither humus nor humans are humble at all. We are audacious, like nature herself. And I think that this is perhaps one of the most profound things that I have read. This idea, this concept that in nature there exists a product of death. Death creates something else. It is radical and disorderly, and we can't understand or define it, but plants can grow out of it. 1 Corinthians 5, 6b through 8 says, do you not know that a little yeast leavens the whole batch of dough? Clean out the old yeast so that you may be a new batch, as you really are unleavened. For our paschal lamb, Christ, has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us celebrate the festival, not with the old yeast, the yeast of malice and evil, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So science lesson number two, and more permission to daydream for a quick minute. So yeast is alive. You bakers know this. You can buy packets of it called active yeast. But yeast, it digests. It can produce. It can die. It can bloom, and bloom is the real technical word for it. If you aren't sure if your yeast is alive, you can check its pulse. Like humus, you add heat and water. So yeast is poured into some hot water, and if it is alive, it will bloom. Basically, what's happening is the hot water activates the yeast, and this living single-celled organism begins to digest the sugar. It converts that into energy that starts to make air bubbles in the water, and that energy will make your dough rise. So we sacrifice yeast's life for our bread or our beer, for our sustenance and our pleasure. And all of these thoughts about humus and yeast were swirling around in my brain, and it just made me aware, again, of this stunning ability that a woman's body has to create life. Female bodies can hold and help grow another human. They can even feed that human for months. And we can't really make our bodies do these things. And there are aids and miracles, yes, but in the end, our bodies either do or don't do these life-giving and sustaining acts. My husband and I have two daughters, and my body was able to create and hold these girls and feed them as well. And it is a miracle that I do not take lightly. But it is hard to confront the fact that I have chosen as a woman to participate in the creation of a life that eventually will die. And I think this is why pregnancy and infancy are so consuming. I think it helps to stay the fact that this too shall end. There's always an exchange. Death for life. A woman gives her body for new life that isn't forever. Plants and yeast and creatures die and decay and will create nourishment and become other plants and creatures. There is always an exchange. I didn't really know death until my son died. My daughters are 5 years apart, and in the space between them, we had a son. His name was Liam. He had a severe neural tube defect, and he was born on February 14th and lived for 3 hours. And it was a really ugly way to get to know death. But because of my son's death, I have known such love and tenderness, generosity, and extravagant sacrifices. Our friend Mike spent the night in the waiting room outside of our hospital room, the whole night on those really uncomfortable hospital couches. Another friend and his wife paid for the entire funeral. My house was bathed in flowers and cards and emails and food. And I would not have chosen that path to learn about loving people in better ways. But because of walking that path, I do know more about listening and responding to those in grief. I know more about the hardness and stark ugliness of life, and therefore I can empathize in ways that would have before been impossible. So I would say that many things grew out of that death. Is that an even exchange then? Death for my life? Death for more love? Or is this an example of the radical disorder of humus? Is this an end product of death that actually gives more life in a completely undefinable way? Was I leavened into sincerity and truth? More simply stated, did death birth something new into my life? Did death create? There is a chapter in the Dirt Book, and it's called The Soil of Graves, and I want to read you a short excerpt. An open grave is an open mouth. It disturbs the soil, throwing the wet, cold subsoil to the surface. It exhales all the suggestions of the dark. But a grave is also the place where the foul is made fair. It is the way that flesh returns to the generative womb. The grave seems to interrupt the human story, but the fact is that graves are motherly for the earth. They wrap up the things of time and deliver them back to the cradle. So that the show goes on, so that nothing will stop the stories from being told. In this regard, every tomb is empty in the long run. If Logan, the author, is correct, and oh, how I want him to be, then death, at least in the natural world, seems to be a kind of mother, a kind of creator. But isn't that exactly the audacious claim we make with Jesus' death? We boast that it isn't final, that this death out of all deaths will create and birth in ways we have no ability to imagine. Isn't that our ultimate hope? Isn't that what we tried to walk through just a week ago? A death, a birth, an empty tomb, where the foul was made fair, where the dead was delivered back to the cradle, so that the story would go on, so that nothing would stop the story from being told. Believing this is audacious and requires learning to see things a little differently. I think Moses, as in the Bible Moses, had to learn to see things differently. Logan, again, the dirt book, I told you it really, really, really got me. He writes about Moses and the burning bush. In Exodus, it is written that Moses turns aside to see a wonder, a bush that is burned but not consumed. A mystery for sure. How can a bush be burning and on fire but not burn up and away? So we have now come to our third and final science lesson. In biology, there are two fundamental equations, a pair, by which all organic life lives. The first equation is one we have all learned about in elementary school. It's the equation of photosynthesis, how plants make food. The second part of the pair is the equation of burning. This equation of burning describes how plants and animals unlock sunlight and turn it into energy that helps them move, feel, think, eat, hunt, whatever their life consists of. Logan writes that based on this second equation, all that is living burns. And perhaps this is what Moses saw. Moses turned aside to see a wonder, a bush that was burning. He didn't see a bush literally on fire. Instead, Logan presumes that maybe Moses saw the bush as it really was, burning as it used the hot eastern sun to dig its roots into the soil and grow. He saw a bush that wasn't being consumed. He saw a bush that was consuming. He saw the bush as it was seen by God, as the bush had been created by God. God finishes this science lesson with Moses by saying, "Take off your shoes, because the ground where you are standing is holy ground." So these three science lessons, one, humus, that physical material that is the result of death that is disordered and undefinable yet provides food, safety, and health to plants. Two, yeast, that living organism that blooms and dies to provide sustenance. And three, that plants and animals burn, and the burning doesn't kill them. Instead, it may be the key to experiencing the plant or animal as it really is. I think these lessons from our natural physical world exist so that we may choose to experience this world differently, so that we may choose to, like Moses, see the world differently, and maybe, maybe, perhaps, see death differently. What if we saw death as that audacious, radically disordered way to create something new, like the humus? Remember in the scripture I read that Paul wrote, our paschal lamb, Christ, has been sacrificed, like the yeast, so that we could be a new batch of bread, something new and different. Now, I think this notion of death as a creator is much easier to reflect and write and think on than it is to actually believe, let alone practice living out. I typed the last half of these words in a hospital room where my dad lay recovering from surgery to remove cancer from his colon. And the thought of death entering into and ending his life, I don't want to participate in that. I don't know that I could choose to see an audacious new beginning, but I know that I want to believe all of this. I want to believe that there is some other product that death creates. As I have written this message and looked at the deaths in my life of my grandmothers and my son, I have been thinking about the cancer in my dad's body, wondering what illness lurks in mine. And I believe this is all part of my humus, my disordered stuff that has undefinably become foundational to myself. Life and newness have come from all of these deaths. And I can't reconcile that. Not really, not in a totally rational way. The best I can do is read a book about dirt and make a metaphor with humus and yeast and use that to help me walk through it. I do have this hope that in writing this and sharing it with you, that I will be able to walk better with my humus and intentionally plant with it. And perhaps that you too will be able to look in your life and find some humus, a little bit of yeast, participate in the equation of burning, and use your humus to help you consume and be transformed into a new creation. Maybe Jesus was able to do all of this already, and we are invited to do our best to follow him and create with death. It's audacious. But maybe audacity is the best way to move from Good Friday to Easter and beyond. We're going to close with a prayer, specifically a prayer of recreation. And I'm going to give you some physical things that you can choose to do with your body. You don't have to do any of them. You can do the movements as I describe them, or you can sit and do them after I finish describing them. But I'll tell you what I want you to do with your body if you choose to participate, and then I'll just say a quick prayer. So you can stand or you can sit. But if you want to, I would want you to lift your arms out and up in a big V position. Try to drop your shoulders down your back. Try to stiffen up your fingers. Stretch by pushing up through your elbows and forearms, reaching toward God, the one who can make bread from yeast. Forests from humus, life from death. Let's pray. We wait. We wait for peace. We wait for what Jesus promised. We wait in our schedules, in our agendas, in our life's routine. We wait. And we extend our hope to believe that God will deliver us and we will be made new. Amen.